Over the past 3 years, you have shown overwhelming support for the Busy Leaders podcast, ranking it in the top 10% of podcasts in the U.S. Today, we are excited to share that the Busy Leaders podcast is getting a new look and a new feel. What began as a tool to learn from leaders as we navigated the pandemic has evolved to focusing in on the changemakers moving healthcare forward. The podcast's new look and feel is intended to reflect and embrace that evolution. We're excited to introduce the Healthcare Plus podcast, hosted by Quint Studer and Dan Collard. In each high-impact segment, Quint and Dan bring together leaders and changemakers from across healthcare to discuss the latest industry insights, offer solutions to some of healthcare's greatest challenges, and provide replenishment and well-being tools that will refill your emotional bank account. With a focus on practical tools, techniques, and best practices, you'll walk away from each episode with ideas you can implement in your own role, organization, and community. I'm Nicole Webb-Bodie, partner at Healthcare Plus Solutions Group. Quint Studer and Dan Collard, your hosts, co-founded Healthcare Plus Solutions Group with the mission of having a positive impact on those that receive care and those that provide care. HPSG specializes in delivering customized solutions that build and develop skills to help healthcare organizations achieve and sustain high performance. Quint is a well-known author, operator, coach, and mentor to many. He has dedicated his time to creating tools and techniques that make healthcare a better place for physicians to practice medicine, patients to receive care, and employees to work. Dan is a seasoned executive with a passion for improving healthcare and leading organizations through change. From rural hospitals to complex health systems and academic medical centers, Dan has helped organizations across the industry attain best-in-class performance. For more information about your host, visit healthcareplussg.com. And now, please welcome today's guest. Joining today's podcast is Dr. Laura McClellan, an associate professor at Virginia Commonwealth University in the Department of Health Administration. She is a highly regarded expert in healthcare management and leadership, workplace compassion, employee well-being, and patient experience. She has won multiple international teaching excellence awards, and her research is published in top health service journals and cited in popular press outlets such as CNN, Kaiser Health News, and NPR. Now, please welcome today's guest, Dr. Laura McClellan, and our host, Quint Studer.
Well, I am so excited. And Laura, for those our listeners, a little bit of background on how we met, because I really appreciate what you did. I spoke at the ACAG conference. And I spoke on, you know, human behavior, my stuff that I talk about, sense of belonging, trust, the human ecosystem. And I told them that, you know, I've got melanoma. And afterwards, you got this message from you that you felt you needed to talk to me. And I remember I was in Wisconsin and I called you and I thought we were going to, I think you thought it was going to be a short conversation. And it probably went, and I think it probably went close to an hour. And we got to hear about your father, but we also connected on some like interest, which is empathy, compassion. And I'm always looking for research. John A. List, who's in the economics department at the University of Chicago, says, well, Quinn, I can usually with what you say, I can back it with research, or I look at the research and then say, well, what's the behavior we need to maximize this? And you're sort of a national expert on compassion, but the impact that compassion has. So let's just talk a little bit about, you know, you're known for your research on compassion. So what inspired you to make that shift? Because, you know, as you heard in the introduction, you weren't in healthcare, you weren't in this arena, yet you now you are. You're into things like empathy and all those wonderful things that some people would call them soft skills, but I'll never say that word because I don't think they are. I think they're very difficult if they're not easy. And I know I'm misinterpreting soft as originally written, but I think that's how people think of it today. So tell us about how this happened and your father and what that impact had on you and your career.
Sure. So I was in grad school at the time in a business school and had no plans to do anything related to compassion or be a compassion researcher, but life has this way of intervening. And it really helped inspire me and find what my true passion was. That was when my father was diagnosed with melanoma as well, stage 4. And I found myself going back and forth from, you know, the university to where my father was receiving treatments. And on the surface, he was receiving care at what I would call a lot of technically excellent facilities that, you know, ostensibly were offering very similar services, but they felt very, very different. And we were blessed as a family to receive care for him at a very special place to me, which was California Pacific Medical Center. And I, you know, as somebody who was studying management and interested in workplace dynamics, I was so struck by the difference in how we were treated, how he was treated. And also, you know, you spend a lot of time when you're in a hospital just sitting around and watching. And I could see the difference in how the staff treated one another. And I could tell you so many beautiful stories about, you know, compassion shown to my parents, and even stories that I could see about how the staff really looked out for each other. And it wasn't just people that were at the bedside, but it was anybody that we interacted with, you know, people in valet, parking, the cafeteria, you name it. It felt like a place of care. And I was so curious about how does this place exist? Like, what is it? What is it that creates these conditions where compassion thrives? And so that really sparked my journey to really understand compassion and the benefits of compassion, and really just the need to build this business case for why compassion matters for healthcare organizations.
I mean, you say to build a business case, and for some people, you're gonna are thinking, well, you shouldn't have to. But the reality, I've been in this a long time, it does help to build a business case. And by the way, I'd love to hear what you said about California Pacific Medical Center. I spent lots of days there working there. So it's wonderful. So you mentioned research, because I do think research, when I'm out talking to people, if I give them a suggestion, like try this, one of the first things somebody's going to say is, tell me, does the research back it? So why don't you talk a little bit about, you've mentioned research, talk a little bit about the research that you've unfolded and what you're sort of hoping the case is for people to focus more on compassion.
So the great thing is that it is a body of research that, you know, back when I started this, there wasn't a lot, I will say. So it was a great opportunity, but there is a growing number of scholars in this space that are doing really phenomenal research. And some of the work that I have done and some of the research that some other folks have done are really starting to show the benefits, you know, backed by science, that compassion is really beneficial to patients in terms of patient outcomes. So it's sort of like that's the first level. And so we know things like, you know, patients, when they experience compassion in caregiving, they report a better care experience. They're more compliant with their medications. Diabetic patients have, you know, their A1C is better controlled. We see evidence that it has immunological benefits. So I can, there's a lot of things that show that compassion is just really, really good for the patient. But it's also really good for employees too. So I think that's kind of like the second level. When people report working in a compassionate environment where they feel like their organization cares for them, where they experience regularly compassion on an everyday basis, we see a tremendous number of benefits for those employees. So those employees report much lower levels of emotional exhaustion. So we are in a crisis of burnout right now for our workforce. It's really important to pay attention to that as a potential tool to address that. We also know that people report that they experience higher levels of teamwork, team performance, productivity. A really important metric for turnover is job satisfaction, and they are more satisfied with their jobs. And then they also curiously report lower levels of ailments like insomnia and fatigue and headaches and back pain. And the list goes on and on. So, you know, when you think about those benefits, like we oftentimes think, well, compassion is a moral imperative in care and it's probably really good for patients. But I think a lot less of the time we really think about the fact that compassion is really beneficial for employees too. And then it's really beneficial for organizations. So that's like that third level. And so it kind of, it cascades, right? So for instance, you think about value-based purchasing. And so we know that when patients are in, you know, care environments where they experience compassion on a more regular basis and the employees are experiencing compassion on a more regular basis and they have that structure in place that sustains it, those overall patient experience scores, the HCAHPS scores, are improved, which has that direct financial implication with that total performance score for value-based purchasing for acute care facilities, which is really important. That's the, you know, the bottom line impact. Patients are less litigious, so that frees up financial resources for organizations. And then we know things like the metrics that we really pay attention to from a quality and safety perspective. If you know that your staff are regularly experiencing a compassionate culture in their organization and they're experiencing lower levels of emotional exhaustion, you're also going to see a decline in things that really matter, like medical errors as well, and turnover rates as well, which are incredibly costly for the organization. And so it's this really powerful tool that, you know, science continues to show the benefits of it. So there's a lot of ways that we can showcase that that compassion is really good for business.
Well, help me. I think people, I've been doing a lot of research lately, working with people that seem to have a blind spot or Johari window per se. And so I get the compassion and I'm a manager or I'm a CEO or I'm an executive. I want to be compassionate. And I know people might be afraid to ask this question because sometimes I think we're afraid to ask a question because we think we're being judged that we should know. So what are some ways that a manager, and I know I'm not trying to be silly, I'm just really curious. I'm a manager. I want to be compassionate. Can you give me some tips on how to demonstrate to my workforce? And I know everybody's an individual, that I am compassionate.
Yeah. So one of the things that I oftentimes like to tell people when we're talking about this is that you have to take compassion and remove like the capital C and make it a lowercase c. So it feels less intimidating in terms of what it means to show compassion and being able to harness these benefits. And so for managers and leaders, really it begins with first acknowledging the fact that suffering in the workplace is normal, unfortunately, but it is entirely normal. And the importance of that is so critical because there is, especially in healthcare, a stigma associated with ill-being. So whether it's burnout or a number of other more concerning issues that we know healthcare workers have a higher rate of. So things like addictive disorders, like alcohol and drug abuse, suicide, for instance, we know they experience it at much greater rates, but there's been this stigma for so long about you don't talk about it, you don't show weakness, you don't ever show signs that you need help. And the sooner I think that managers can realize the fact that this work is really hard and it can be very traumatic for our healthcare workforce, the sooner people will feel safer to open up and have conversations and say, I need help. Right? So it's really creating that safe space. But in terms of other practical ways, I think that one of the neatest parts about understanding compassion is that for compassion to be beneficial, you simply have to try. It's not about actually taking away somebody's suffering, but the benefits accrue by people simply attempting to help. And so when leaders model that on a regular basis and engage in perspective taking, putting themselves in the shoes of somebody else, their staff, for instance, and really trying to understand what they're struggling with, what they're doing is they're showing that compassion is expected and normal and appropriate, and other people that work for them will start to show that too. But then I think the third piece that's really critical is building the scaffolding. And this is something that is really on not just managers, but the organization more broadly. And really trying to understand, do you have the structures in place so that compassion happens reliably? And so what is it that you are doing regularly to try and infuse compassion into your organization? Do you actually try and hire people who are more likely to show compassion? Do you use behavioral interviewing questions, for instance, that tap into that? What are you doing to sustain compassion? So to what extent do you regularly as a manager recognize and reward acts of compassion that happen on an everyday basis? And it's not just compassion shown to patients, but compassion that's shown amongst the staff too. How do you celebrate that? Again, what it does is it normalizes it and reminds people that this is what we value here. And then I think the last one is really about replenishing. And I know this is something that you talk about in your work. And it's recognizing that this work is really difficult. So how do you try and create structures that buffer, protect, but also replenish when your staff are feeling depleted or they're suffering? So are you using tools like Schwartz rounds, for instance, where you're bringing your clinicians together to talk about the non-clinical aspects of a difficult case? Are you implementing the pause, for instance? So there is a holding space for grief. How do you use your pastoral care staff, for instance? Are they primarily used for your patients and family members? Or do you think about how you could use them as well to help take care of the people that are taking care of your patients? It's really about using those resources to help people feel well, because the reality is that people bring their whole selves to work even when they don't want to. And the sooner that we normalize that and we create an environment where we have these structures in place, we create this community that looks out for each other. And it really begins at the top with leaders modeling this, having these structures, rather than just solely relying on what I find troubling. And that is when you have staff that are burned out, for instance, constantly asking them to do the hard work to go get help because they don't have that capacity to do so. And so how can the organization take better care of their people?
Well, I love everything you've said. And I'm sitting here because, you know, one of the things I try to do is put tools to research. And one of the things that, the data just shows people don't take care of themselves that well in healthcare. And if you're not well yourself, it's hard to get other people well. Dr. Catherine Meese at University of Alabama, Birmingham, and I were talking the other day, and she talked about something called a passion tax. And what she means by that is because our healthcare workers are so passionate about what they do, they're very resilient. Research shows they're resilient or they wouldn't be in healthcare. But sometimes we can take advantage of that passion. If we're an executive team, because people are so passionate, they're going to tolerate some suffering themselves more than others because they're so committed to their profession. You know, they're committed to what they do. And I'm not talking just about direct caregivers. Those that support the caregivers have just as much compassion as anyone. So I think this whole idea of quiet suffering is more to me than the quiet resignation is I'm not going to let anybody know. I was talking to a very great organization in many, many ways, and they offer probably more resources and well-being than you can imagine. Yet only 1% of their employees ever access it. One of the early podcasts I did with Banner Health, they actually put mental health workers in their facilities that go to the huddles. They're part of the staff. So it's not like, and people see them talk and they just figure they're part of the staff. The last tip that we've been utilizing is, but it has to start at the top. And that's what I say. If you tell managers to do it, but you're not doing it at the C-suite, it becomes optional. So if one of the things, again, we learn this from other people. I'm just like somebody that takes little ideas and seeds them in other places. We've been asking people, what's your battery if you were a phone? What would your charge be? And it takes a while, but it's amazing how people get comfortable with that. And the other neat thing about healthcare is when somebody says I'm a 50, the people that are an 80 immediately start talking to the person that's a 50 and says, gee, what can we do? Sometimes, like you said, it's something at home. I told people early on, there were two myths that people told me when I first got into healthcare years ago. And I think I believed them because of my laziness. One of the myths were separate work and home. And I found out you cannot do that. You cannot do that. People take their whole self to work. Then they take work home with them too. And the other thing, of course, is balance, reward, and recognition, which is another myth, because if you balance it, people feel crummy because you need to do a lot more reward than recognition. So I think for managers, some of the tips that you've given, but tell me when you're interviewing someone, how do I know about this compassion? Because sometimes I'll say to somebody, Jay, how do you know your patient are mission oriented? They said, well, because we talk about the mission during orientation. So isn't that a little late? They're already here. Are there some ways that you can sort of see if somebody has compassion or not?
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. I was doing some research with an academic medical center, and I was talking to a woman who is in charge of hiring for parking and valet parking in particular for this large urban academic medical center. And she talked about how, you know, they would hire people and they would look for certain characteristics. And she said, you know, there's a lot that I can teach people. I can teach people about where things are located, or I can teach them about healthcare, but I can't teach them to be nice, right? And so what she would do in her interview questions was asking things about, you know, tell me about a time where you noticed a coworker was having a hard day and what did you do? Or tell me about a time where you took care of one of your own, and that person can fill in whatever that means for them. And if people are really struggling with those answers, it gives you a better sense of, is this somebody who comes to work and keeps those blinders on, or do they by chance not only do their work, but they take notice of their colleagues? Do they form relationships with their colleagues? Because it's our colleagues who are the best at detecting when we are not well, right? They notice those small, tiny, subtle changes when we're a bit off, we're not our usual selves. And that's exactly what organizations need, and C-suite needs to understand, is that that's how we quickly can help people, is when our colleagues know us, you know, well enough that they can intervene and check in with us and say, like with your example with your battery, that you can detect that somebody's only at 50%. But if people are always going to come to work with those blinders on and not pay attention to those subtle cues, or that someone's battery is at 50%, that might give me pause as to whether or not I might want to hire someone.
No, I think that's so important. I think also just asking the question in the interview lets them know what you're looking for. Lets them know Absolutely. How they feel. Lets them know that that's important to you, because there's story after story. I have an artwork right here I look at every day. It's from Madison Atwood, who's a special needs adult. And she sent it, her father, Jeff Atwood, sent it to me. And we've gone back years and years and years when Madison was little. And they what took her to Vanderbilt, and they were pretty intimidated and scared, the whole situation. They parked in the parking garage. And they were really wondering, is this the right place, the whole bit. They walked out, and the security guard said, I want you to know I've been praying for you the entire time you've been in there. And I get teary-eyed just talking about it. And emotionally, that was a message to them that we're in the right place. Do you think we underestimate reward and recognition? Because I just look at, and I'm not talking about a massage chair or a tote bag, you know, for everybody. I'm just thinking, again, the more I read research, I've been reading a lot of research lately from other people. It seems to me in healthcare, looking at the latest research, we go back to maybe underestimating what recognition or reward means, particularly on an individual personal level. Can you talk a little bit about how that connects into compassion?
Absolutely. So I think reward is also closely related to its cousin, which is gratitude. So I think it's important to talk about both. So I think what rewards do, and they can be very small forms of rewards, which is just going up to somebody and saying, you know, that was great what you did. It could be small things that the organization does structurally to have systems in place where people can acknowledge the great things that their colleagues are doing. And in this case, you know, we're talking about compassion, but showing acts of compassion. And it could be comment cards and small ways in which people are regularly recognized. And I think that's the key piece, is it has to be regular. And what it does is it regularly reminds people that the behavior is expected and appropriate. But the other part that I think is also really important too is gratitude and harnessing the power of gratitude, because we know from research that when people show compassion and show acts of care and they are thanked for doing so, it's an amplifier. And what it does is it tells people that what they did was helpful and that they should do it again. So it's a good signal. And people who are thanked for doing that are more likely to do it again. And not just to the same person, but to other people too. So it can spread throughout an organization. And it's such an easy, low cost, no cost tool to say, thank you.
In my book, The Calling, you know, and I know, but right, the first page says it's impossible. You know, a heart full of gratitude is, it doesn't leave room for anything else. And not because it comes natural to me, by the way. I have to work on all these things because it doesn't come natural. I work with three men. Us four have a little pack. We've all had depression over the years and suicide thoughts over the years. And so every morning, we've been doing this for years, we send a list of three things we're grateful for from the day before. And the guy who got into it last told me that he just thought it was so goofy and it's made such a huge impact on his life. And I think, you know, gratitude is important. And I think sometimes it just happens because healthcare is so big. You know, we're saving hearts, we're opening chests, we're doing such incredible things that it sometimes maybe we just forget those types of things, what they mean. Someone, Nicole's really great at that. You know, we have an employee who has a birthday, and man, they've decorated her area. We've all signed cards, and it makes a difference. So I love what you're talking about. So as you look over your research, and you look at, you know, yourself, and you're a difference maker. You and I are going to do some work together, which I'm very excited about. What keeps you going? Because, you know, you got, you know, two daughters, a 14-year-old and about a 5-year-old. You've gone back and you teach at Virginia Commonwealth University, which is such a great, great place. What keeps you going?
So I think a lot of it is, it's really about paying it forward for me. So I am very grateful for the experience that my father, my family had at CPMC and the care that he received. And I'm a firm believer that it was that combination between technical excellence and compassion shown to us that really transformed what was a really dire time. He was given a 2% chance of survival that then enabled him to live for another decade and live to meet the birth of all four of his grandchildren. And so it's a personal mission to really show this science so that we can translate into practice so that it can transform the lives of patients and people so they can be in work environments where they're thriving and happy and healthy. And that's what fills my cup every day. And I'm fortunate because I have the privilege of working at VCU and teaching. And I teach MHA and MSHA students, and they're going out and they are the future leaders of healthcare. And I get to talk to them about compassion, and they get it. And they're excited by it, and they want to take that out into their workplaces. And so, again, it's about spreading that fire that they are going to be utilizing these tools that have such far-reaching opportunities. And it's just very fulfilling.
I think the neat part is you're teaching them self-replenishment techniques, too, because I'd like to promise people you're going to be in a great culture, great organization. But sometimes it just doesn't work like that. And we have to take responsibility for our own replenishment at times too. But I think what's really wonderful about what you're doing, I think when most people are students, they're all excited. You know, if they get into your school, they put it on social media that they're going to your school. If they get a residency, they put their on residency. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be at your place for 2 days. And I mean, people, cups are full, they're excited. But they're going to go out there and there's going to be times there's withdrawals. And I think the fact that you're connecting to that, when people ask me, why am I so excited about the future of healthcare? It's just what you said. Because I, during the pandemic, offered to do free webinars for healthcare administration programs throughout the country. And I got to see all these people getting master's and MBA, MHA, and so on. And that's what I feel so great about, because I think they're bringing something to the table. They understand the most important metrics we have is, are we filling the hearts of the people that work for us, and are we filling the hearts of the people that we provide care to? So I'm very, you filled my cup today, Laura. You're a replenisher in my life, and you're going to continue to be, because we're very excited about taking some of this research, because I find people want to know how, like you mentioned, how do I put this into practice? And I guess what you, to close, you're telling people it doesn't have to be big. They can start with little, make the capital C a small C. That's what I heard, right?
Yeah. I think sometimes people feel intimidated. So one of the things that prevents compassion is people don't know how they should respond or what they should do. They see that a colleague is in distress, or you know, that maybe a patient is having issues and they don't exactly know how to alleviate it. But the more that organizations can have resources that are regularly used, it's not just having them, you know, it's about regularly using them and seeing your colleagues regularly using them, you legitimate it. And it just increases the likelihood that people will respond with compassion. And it can be these small everyday gestures of just checking in with a colleague and asking them if they're okay, or picking them up a cup of coffee, or, you know, patient stories too. There are so many of them. And I mentioned so many favorites from my time with my father at CPMC, but you know, it's these tiny gestures that make us feel like humans and that we're cared for, that whole, our whole person. And you know, my father was pretty delirious during certain days where he was experiencing going through biochemo. And there was this one morning where he woke up briefly at shift change and happened to see that his RN had written the date on the board. And you know, in this state of feeling very groggy, my mother was downstairs getting breakfast from the cafeteria. He mumbled something about the fact that it was their wedding anniversary, and then immediately fell back to sleep. And my mother came up, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes later, and in my father's room were hand-picked flowers from the flower beds outside and a handmade card that, you know, the whole unit, including his physician, had signed, wishing my parents a happy wedding anniversary. And these are really small but beautiful gestures that so deeply touch us, that these are small things. These are these grand gestures, but they become so extraordinary in the lives of the people that they touch.
Wow, that's beautiful. And, you know, for those of you that haven't seen us, I've got tears in my eyes. Nicole Webb is, you know, Nicole Webb is crying while we're doing these. She manages this whole thing. So I want to thank you, Laura. I mean, I'm so blessed that you heard me speak and we connected. And I'm looking forward to continuing this relationship of working together to help people. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Healthcare Plus podcast. For more information about our upcoming events, visit healthcareplussg.com.